Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey guys, before we get into the episode, I just want to say thank you to everyone on Patreon. I know things are crazy in this world right now, and people are losing their jobs and stuff, and just really value everyone who's been able to stick with us on Patreon. I know there was a few of you who had to drop out, and listen, I get it. There's no sense throwing money at a podcast when, you know, you need the money for your family. So I'm totally understanding if you got to drop out, but if you don't, you know, and you're still with us there on Patreon, which a good 30 of you are or so, I just want to say I appreciate it, and we will continue to bring you the Mark Striegel podcast episode every Friday on Patreon. That's patreon.com/talkingmetal. I do that page with Victor Ruiz, who has his own podcast, and Victor's podcast is called Mars Attacks. And by the way, there's a new episode of Talking Rock out with me and Joey Haney, which you can hear on talkingrock.net. That's my website, talkingrock.net. It's all about Rush today, guys. Let's do this.
Hi, I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. On this episode, we're going to talk some rock, some metal, and anything else we feel like. We're also going to jam some tunes, have a drink, and share some honest opinions. Thanks for listening to the Talking Metal Podcast. Let's get things started. Here's an old classic that sounds just as good today as it did when we were kids. We'll be right back.
Anthem by Rush. When Rush put out that second record, Fly By Night, I think within 15 seconds of that first song there off the second Rush album, we knew that things were different. Neil Peart was in the band, and it was definitely going somewhere a little different than it did on that first record. And you can hear that immediately when that intense opening. It's like a ice pick in the forehead opening. So freaking good. We're going to talk with Martin Popoff, metal historian, if you will, about Rush, about his new books about Rush, one of which I have read. It's called Anthem. It's a great read. What better time than now to read a book, right, guys? So let's do this. An interview with Martin Popoff here on Talking Metal. Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and a guy we've had on the podcast numerous times over our almost 15-year career as a podcast here, and a guy I always look forward to talking to, Martin Popoff. Martin, how are you, man?
Hey, I'm doing okay, Mark. Thanks for having me again. It's very cool.
You bet, man. And man, what a time to give you a little press and promotion here, because we're all kind of held up in our houses here, and man, your books are a great thing to get us through these times, this COVID-19 quarantine times, because you had so many good ones through the years that I've read, and just completely psyched because a few months back, actually before Neil passed, I got this great book in the mail, Anthem, Rush in the 1970s. And this is just an awesome read. It's my favorite era of Rush is the 1970s, and just love all the stories that are coming from this book. And it turns out, correct me if I'm wrong, Martin, but this is just the first of three books, right?
Yes. So we've got that one. I think that title is a little, it got changed a bit. It's just Anthem Rush in the 70s, hopefully. I mean, that is what it's going to be.
But, okay.
We've got that one. Then we've got Limelight Rush in the 80s. And then we've got Driven Rush in the 90s and in quotation marks in the end, as per the song, right? So it goes right up to the end. So yeah, it's a trilogy of books. This one comes out, I think, next week. And the next one is October. And then the next one is spring of 2021. Well, it could be a completely different world even by right. October. Who knows, right? But yeah, that's the plan. They've all been written, finished for well over a year, maybe even 2 years in some cases, like with the first one. But yeah, it just feels like it's been a long time. But they go through a long editing process and stuff. This is a big, good, traditional publisher here in Toronto. They're the company that did my first Rush book way back in 03, Contents Under Pressure. That was the authorized one. They've done all of Neil Peart's books. His latest, the last ones that he ever did, not his earlier self-published ones. But yeah, big music book publisher and all sorts of books publisher. And they're oddly, their office is literally like a 15-minute walk from my office, which is really cool. It makes it really convenient.
right on. And now you worked on one of my favorite music documentaries. You've actually worked on a few of them, which we'll talk about maybe later in the interview. But I'm talking about Beyond the Lighted Stage, the documentary that Banger Films did. You were involved with that. And from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but these books kind of spun out of that documentary in a way.
Yes, definitely. So I worked on that. I was full time there. I was like a research guy and a little bit on the story thing, but finding all sorts of cool stuff to put in it and whatnot, and transcribing interviews, doing a lot of that. So I had a lot of that in my computer. And then just one day, just out of the blue, I was just thinking, what's my next project going to be? And I thought I'd approach those guys. It was years later. And I said, hey, if we paid you a few bucks, could we use the, all this great interview footage that doesn't go in the movie? Because what happens in a movie is essentially they have this kind of rule of thumb where like you will film an hour's worth of stuff and use a minute of it. And so we had tons and tons and tons of stuff that we never used. And I thought, this stuff's got to get seen. And I feel that way with a lot of docs that I've been part of over there, right?
Right.
There's just all this great footage locked up there. So they were fine with that. And we checked with the office, and the Rush office was fine with that. Everything's cool. And so we got their blessing. That was the only way I felt like I could ever do another Rush book. I never had any plans to, because I did that first one, which was the authorized one, but it was a little thin. It was only like a 60,000 word book. Then I did Rush, the Illustrated History for Voyager. And in that one, I vowed not to overlap with the first one. So I used sort of outside press and interviews that I had after the first book. And then we did Rush album by album. I did that series of those five books. And that's just getting a bunch of experts together and talking about each studio album. So that didn't overlap. And so for this one, I thought, okay, this is going to be the big enchilada. You know, I'm going to use everything I've got, because it's with the same publisher as the original one, so I can use all that again. Plus all this great extra footage, plus other interviews I've had with the band, plus outside press. And then the last thing I wanted to do is I was inspired a little bit by these this Clash and this Led Zeppelin book I did, All the Albums, All the Songs, where it's just like straight monastic 400 to 500 right. words, straight analysis by me on every single song. And I thought, okay, I'm gonna throw in more of my opinion and more of my analysis into it as well. So we just threw all this stuff at it. And the original plan was we were going to do just one book, and then we just had enough for three books.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the book that I read, Anthem. You said Anthem in what
Rush
is the
Rush in the 70s on that
Rush
cover,
in the 70s.
It says Rush in the 1970s. We had to
oh, check. Okay, so just Rush in the 70s. I got it. Yeah, because I have an advanced copy, I guess. But yeah, the one thing at the beginning of the book that really struck me, and you know, I guess I'd heard this. Maybe it was mentioned in the movie, but I never really thought about it and felt it as heavy as I did from the book was Geddy Lee's father, a Holocaust survivor that really dies young. I mean, when Geddy's quite young, he dies possibly because of injuries that he took on during the Holocaust.
Yeah. Yeah, and mom was a Holocaust survivor too, right? So,
yeah.
And that's how they met, right? I think they met in the second camp or something. It's quite a story. And then yeah, Geddy was 12, and yeah, I guess his father kind of never got over the injuries that he had from being in a camp. So Geddy was the man of the house pretty quick, right?
Yeah. You know, which really brother, forms who he is. At least that's what I take from the book.
Yeah. And he was really responsible right away. You know, and he was always conflicted about quitting school and being a rock star, right? And not going to college and stuff like that. I think that's another reason he became such a Renaissance man and a learned man. You know, he's so into books. Well, he's into reading, but he's into even collecting books, right?
Yeah.
But he's into so many different things. He's a wine expert and all that, as we know, right? And he's, you know, healthy guy, does a lot of sports, so does Alex. So I think a lot of that made him pretty responsible right away. And, you know, and then there's this narrative always, you know, that I don't know if I fully ascribe to, but this thing about Canadians being just sensible, solid, salt of the earth people and all this, right? You know, he's growing up in the suburbs. And Alex, I mean, there's basically not a lot of scandal with Rush. So I think that feeds into it as well. We know they're you know, they're polite, you know, kind of conservative dudes, right? So they basically came up and were pretty organized and solid about what they did, as was Neil, right? I mean, Neil obviously is the same way. He's the professor, right?
right. And you know, you mentioned Neil, but there was another drummer before Neil that we don't really think about that much. At least I don't. When I think of Rush, I think of, you know, yeah, Geddy, Alex, Neil, but John Rutsey, I mean, he truly was the leader of the band. At least that's what I'm taking from the book.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so much leader of the band, but he was probably number one. He was the biggest partier. He was kind of a rock star dude. He drank and stuff. Yet he had diabetes, so he had always, you know, these health problems and stuff. I wouldn't say per se leader of the band, but he was kind of like he was almost like, I don't know if he was even the feared guy in the band, but he's a little bit like it's a little bit like the Ace Frehley of the band and even the Paul Di'Anno in the band. So okay. Paul Di'Anno was a little bit the ruffian and maybe a little bit kind of like feared. Oh, what's he going to do next? And I almost get that feeling with John Rutsey. But we do get that impression when we see that really awesome lost footage of that playing in that high school, that he was the spokesman on stage in the band, which is quite bizarre, right? He's the guy announcing the songs and giving the little, hey, how you doing, everybody out there? right? Which is pretty wild. You see that in the footage that that you get in the film. That story of finding that is pretty interesting. They, you know what I'm talking about, right? This.
I haven't seen the film in a number of years, but I do have a recollection of what you're talking about.
They,
yeah,
and then they put more of it on the DVD extras. But essentially, what was found. We found was a long lost full concert professionally shot in a high school. The only moving footage of John, video footage of John. So it was the original band playing like six or seven songs, half of them that are not on any album. And this is, I think Fly By Night is on there way before Fly By Night comes out. I think one of the songs anyways, but so that was a funny story. I mean, I wasn't there at the time on this particular trip to the office, but we went to the Anthem offices and they were just rummaging through a bunch of stuff, and they found, I think it was a VHS or one of those older formats with a little yellow sticky on it that says, "What the F is this?" And that's it.
Right.
it's not marked in any way. And they took it away and played it. And it was like the, you know, it was this thing that we knew existed that I had been looking for all this time. I had, you know, through my research found that, you know, this footage, it was really bizarre. Like there was this big TV station in this small town in Ontario, Kitchener, and the TV station bought the old brick house next door and just took all the footage that they ever filmed of anything and just hucked it into this room in this old house. And then the house burned down or everything was thrown out from it or whatever. Wow. So there was all this like, oh my God, we hear this exists, because we saw black and white pictures of this high school concert with big, massive, you know, proper video cameras, and thought, oh man, if we could only find that. And then, so lo and behold, it was sitting in the Rush office, you know, all the time with a little yellow sticky on it.
Yeah. And it's interesting how early on in the picture too, Terry Brown comes into the equation as the Rush producer,
yeah,
who would be with them just like for how long? I mean, just for decades, literally, right?
Well, right through, not decades, but right from, he helps patch up the first album, and then he's there for every single in the 70s all the way through to Signals.
Okay. All right.
So 1980, yeah, like he's there for Permanent Waves, 80, 80.
Okay. So he didn't do Grace Under Pressure then.
Right. That's the first one he doesn't do. So he's all the way there right up until Signals.
And there's this, speaking of the first record, there's this story that, that's in the book, and I just wanted to clarify this. So John wrote, like Neil would in the years to come, wrote lyrics, and they go in to record, and I guess it was right before they start recording the first album, John suddenly loses the lyric sheets or decides he doesn't want his lyrics used, and they basically write the lyrics just on the fly for the first record. Getty ends up writing them.
Yeah, it's like I think John tore them up or something.
That's what it says in the book. Yeah,
he was pretty. He was a temperamental guy, so they were always a little. And he would ostracize people. That's the word that Alex used in there, right? So he would be into these sort of petty friendship games, I guess. You know, you'd be ostracized or whatever. So yeah, that really ticked the guys off. So they always knew he was a little bit of an unpredictable guy. It's a little bit like the Steven Tyler stories that you remind me of. Like don't we hear stories of him having all the lyrics ready to go for the album, then he loses the notebook or whatever, leaves it on top of a car in a restaurant or something.
And it said in the book, you know, John, I think it was Alex or maybe it was Getty, John regretted that they didn't use his lyrics, you know, for years to come, I'm sure, because that was been a financial gain for him.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So Terry Brown in the picture early, helping, I guess, remix certain songs, re-record some parts, and then they record, I guess, three new songs with him. That first record comes out, and it really catches on in the city of Cleveland. I guess Working Man is getting played on WMMS. And I found that to be interesting. It seemed like Cleveland was a really important town for Rush in breaking them, at least in the States.
Yeah, it was, as was Pittsburgh and St. Louis. I mean, Casey in St. Louis was a big deal as well. You know, so they were, you know, it's a little bit funny. I have my own podcast, and I'm remembering back now, the very first episode I did was Led Zeppelin and hair metal, right? And, you know, talked about things like Kingdom Come. And so it's funny that they probably got a little bit of a leg up simply for a couple of novelty factors. Number one, there is the obvious story that, you know, everybody thought this was the new Led Zeppelin, or at least sounded very much like Led Zeppelin. So there was that comparison. But then Geddy's voice also is kind of a novelty voice. I never thought he sounded like Robert Plant, but it definitely is a novelty voice. So it's one of these things that people will talk about for good or worse, but they say, you know, no publicity is bad publicity, right? Or bad publicity is okay publicity, right? Whatever, right? So there was a lot to talk about when you get an album like that. I mean, it was also quite well recorded, quite accomplished, uncommonly heavy for the day. I mean, there really wasn't much American heavy metal. I also did two episodes on my podcast about the origins of UK metal versus American metal, and American metal was still pretty backwards and boogie based, right? We came up with, you know, they had the big MC5 and Stooges thing going, but then it was like Cactus and Mountain, and it was still like post-British blues boom stuff, right? But by 74, I mean, Aerosmith is just getting going. Blue Oyster Cult is just getting going. Kiss's first album is 74. There's that great, great Montrose album, of course. That's probably the best first heavy metal album out of America. But, you know, this Rush album is pretty darn heavy and well put together and cool and exciting. So it's no wonder that I think it caught on. There just really wasn't anything like it at the time.
Right on. And what was there a gap, you know, for these bands like Rush and Aerosmith to kind of come in? I mean, Deep Purple was basically falling apart at that point. I mean, Ian Gillan was gone. They were going a different direction. There were some Zeppelin, even, you know, I mean, we all now look back at Physical Graffiti as a masterpiece, which it was, but there was something that wasn't quite as commercial about that record as there had been the earlier Zeppelin records. Was there an opening for newer bands to come in at that time?
Yeah, there is kind of that theory. I mean, it's more of a you know, 75 to 79 thing,
right?
Because I just did an episode on this on my History in Five Songs podcast thing, where it was, I did the late 70s UK and the late 70s US, just like I did the early 70s. There's four kind of episodes that tell this story, but yeah, so you had Led Zeppelin going away in 79, but being patchy already and being considered a little bit stodgy, even, you know, post. You know, Physical Graffiti is awesome, but Presence got some bad reviews, and In Through the Outdoor was not heavy enough and all this, right? But right. Deep Purple's completely gone, and they're all off doing their fusion bands, Pace Ashton Lord, John Lord solo, Roger Glover solo, the Ian Gillan band.
Right, he was
a heavy band. Yeah. So Rainbow starting up, yeah. And Black Sabbath's falling apart. You know, Technical Ecstasy didn't get good reviews. Your Eye Heap is kind of going away. They lose David Byron at that point, right? So all the big early bands are kind of going away. And yeah, into the wake steps Kiss, Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, Blue Oyster Cult, Heart, Journey, Boston, Rush, you know, a couple smaller bands, Moxie from Canada, Triumph from Canada, what else? Derringer,
yeah.
Was one, Stars, Angel. So yeah, there was this, you know, it is considered a bit of a golden era of American hard rock. But that really doesn't really, you know, they don't get the payoff really until about 76, which coincidentally is when Rush breaks big with 2112. Right. They have first gold album.
Yeah, I do want to talk about 2112, which is a really important record for me, one of my favorite albums. But real quick, Kiss, you mentioned Kiss, and you know, a lot of times when we hear about bands touring together, there's friction, you know, between the two bands, but Kiss and Rush seem to get along so great. I mean, musically different bands, different musically for sure. But in some ways, I mean, I loved both bands as a kid. So, I mean, I think there was a big crossover audience, but these guys really liked each other.
Yeah, there's a couple things there. I've never thought about this, and that's a really cool question you ask. I mean, you know, first of all, Rush are likable guys. They're not going to do anything to tick off the Kiss guys, right? I mean, they're just likable dudes, right? And also, they're really studious in what they're doing. So even though, so here's the other thing. So Rush is kind of like no threat to Kiss in a way, because Kiss can just blow everybody away with their stage show and stuff, and these songs that are really well written and direct and simple to understand. So they recognize that Rush is doing a totally different thing, and they're probably even going to get a little ridiculed and given a hard time before Kiss goes on. So they're probably even getting a little sympathy from the guys. But on the same token, you know, the Kiss guys were pretty, you know, pretty serious about what they were doing from a musical, you know, idea. They were big music fans, put it that way. So they could probably respect Rush as well, how good they were as musicians. And yeah, they just got along. They were doing different things. And this was the era of, you know, a lot of three band bills, a lot of, you know, the sandwich band in the middle, all these bands that we just talked about all toured together. And it was also the era when it wasn't so organized that you had strictly a certain backup band for a long, long time, like a single tour start to finish. There was a lot of just jumping on wherever you happened to be. And right. Then also there was a lot of filling in the gaps between the big shows at the hockey barn. You would just go play the local theater or the local club on the way if you had a day off or whatever, right? So that, right. So all these bands worked super hard, and, you know, sometimes they were good for two albums a year. And yeah, it was just this, you know, Geddy says it the best, you know, when he says it. I remember, you know, I think this might have been an in-person interview with him at one point or whatever, but, you know, he said just that life takes a chunk out of your soul, right?
Right.
You hear about like the 1,000-yard stare or whatever. It just really beats something out of you doing that. So I think all those guys that go through that crucible, you know, have a lot of respect for each other for fighting that war, right?
Right on. Like when Rush opened for Sha Na Na, which you mentioned in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or show up and, you know, the club owners thinks he's getting the folk guy, Tom Rush, right?
Right, right. And we're talking with Martin Popoff about his book, Anthem, Rush in the 70s. Great, great stuff. A must read for all Rush fans. And Martin, the book is available when again?
Pretty much, I would say mid-April.
Okay.
By the end of April. It's literally, you know, even with this virus going on, I mean, there are, like I say, you know, we were talking before, my personal supply chain has not been broken. My mailing house has stayed open. Miraculously, these books that I'm receiving from various places, the print shops have stayed open, or sometimes they've been printed overseas. But this is a big, thick hardcover. It's a read. It's not a photo book like a lot of my other big Rush books have been. So it's got photo sections, but it's like a big substantial read sort of thing. But I am getting copies soon, and I'll have them at my website, martinpopoff.com. As I usually, you know, I always have a supply of everything I do. I ship them, sign them here, ship them out. There'll be PayPal buttons and all that stuff for them. But yeah, so you know, apparently, even though there's no bookstores, you know, publishers have that problem,
right?
But places like me that do a lot of mail order as part of their monthly deal. I'm you know, touch wood, at least for now, we're not closed down.
Awesome. That's great news. And let's talk about again that album, that just amazing record, 2112. It was really, from what I'm reading in the book, like it was a make or break record for them.
Yeah, so they had the, you know, the Down the Tube tours and the Down the Tubes tour on Caress of Steel, and the album Caress of Steel, which was a step back. They had all that excitement with the debut. Fly By Night had a hit on it with Fly By Night. It was doing well. The band was on the up and up, and then things took a dive with Caress of Steel. It was considered to be just a little obscure and weird, and a little bit, like Geddy says, we smoked a lot of pot making that record.
Right.
But then they decided, well, okay, if we're going to crash in flames, we're going to go down our way. This is where they really kind of gained their independence. They made essentially, you know, I don't think 2112 is that much different of an album from Caress of Steel. It's structured pretty much the same way. But, you know, I guess the songs are a little better. The production's better. Caress of Steel was a little thin. I didn't have a lot of
There's like an anger. I feel like there's more of an oomph and almost an anger to 2112, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a little more majestic, and yeah, a little more confidence. Everything's just a little better. Caress of Steel almost sounds like the demo version of 2112, I guess, in a little ways. But really, 2112, to my mind, is not that much more of a commercial record. It's just quite non-commercial, as was Caress of Steel. So essentially they make this album, and surprise, it does well. I mean, prog is big at this time. This is a progressive metal band. This is the band that invented progressive metal, right? I mean, literally they took prog and they took metal and just jammed them together. I mean, it's a pretty clear formula, and they're right. The only ones doing it. Nobody dares copy them, right? I mean, I always think the closest things that you would consider close to this are Styx, Kansas, a little bit of Uriah Heep, maybe a little bit of King Crimson, but all of those are way different than Rush anyways. Yeah. Right. But you know, they got the matching toga look on the back and this big sci-fi story, and it's a gatefold and it's got the pentagram. So it's got a lot going for it. Hard rock's a big deal at the time. Prog is a big deal at the time. Concept records are accepted. Radio stations would play a whole side or whatever, or a whole album. They didn't seem to mind. So yeah, it just by sheer force of their will and by sheer force of doing something really unique, it went over. And you know, it didn't go over huge. It became a gold album, right? But that was enough to to keep their career going on the up and up.
Absolutely. And I did want to ask you a few non-Rush questions, but before we do that, Neil, his interviews that you did with him, any memories you can share, any personal thoughts you want to share about Neil?
Yeah. I mean, Neil, the great thing about Neil is that it's really funny. Like one thing I just love about the way he ran his life when it came to interviewing. So there's always this big myth that Neil doesn't do interviews, right? But right. If you go back, he did a ton of interviews all through the whole Rush time. It's only later on after the tragedies that he kind of withdrew in a big way, right? But he was good in those early interviews. He would engage. He would not be patronizing. He would talk politics or whatever. And that seemed to bite him on the butt a couple times, like when he got, you know, when they started going in all this libertarian Ayn Rand stuff, right? But no, he was good. And then, yeah, sure, he withdrew. But then he decided, the funny thing is, he decided that, okay, yeah, I'm not going to do interviews, but I'm going to write these massive books that are going to be the ultimate Neil interviews. And no one's going to have to ask me anything ever again, because I'm just going to tell them everything in these books. And that's what he did with his life, right? But the corollary to that is that when you did get an interview with him and talk to him, he would be great. He'd be a killer interview. He'd talk your ear off, just like he talked the Bangers guys' ears off. He talked about everything. And that's why this trilogy of books is going to have so much good, rich stuff when you get into the 80s and 90s as well, because there's lots and lots of Neil, right, that we haven't seen. But yeah, he was the same with me. It was just, he was really engaging and, you know, would answer all my questions and stuff. You know, I knew that there's always with him, you know, you got to know that there's that thorny thing, is that he doesn't want to be praised. And, you know, and also he had this thing that he would quickly and easily get embarrassed by his old material and think the newer material's great. And, oh, my God, I hate the old stuff. I don't, you know, which is crazy, because everybody loves the 70s Rush and the later stuff not so much. Right. But Neil would be probably the opposite. I mean, he would praise to the hills the new stuff, but he'd be the one guy out of the three that would probably disown the early material the most.
That's interesting, because I do remember as a kid, like the first time I saw Rush was on the Grace Under Pressure tour. And I remember reading interviews with them at that time. And there was this real thing with them where they didn't want to be associated with any of the hard rock bands. You know, they wanted to be more associated with the Police, and they kept talking about the Police, and they don't listen to hard rock. They don't like hard rock. So that's kind of interesting. That of course would have been in the 80s, mid 80s. Were they really, do you remember them trying to really distance themselves from their roots at that time?
Oh, for sure. You know, I always like fantasize, dream that, oh, what if they went like Uriah Heep and did Abominog or Budgie and did Power Supply or Black Sabbath? Like, what if they embraced the new wave of heavy metal instead of running away from it, right?
Right.
Because they were loved at that time, right? And they were loved by the British, you know, those albums. I mean, you think of Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures. I mean, they would have, could have been probably even more massive had they gone heavier even, right?
Right.
and just been this big, you know, just duking it out with Judas Priest and who else? Scorpions and Ozzy at the time. Right. But, you know, they kind of ended up doing that anyways. They kind of ended up being accepted despite going in this direction and being, you know, frankly, quite trendy and doing a lot of things that don't stand the test of time because they were such curious guys that they were, technology adopters, early adopters, right? Mm-hmm. So they would early adopt things when they weren't quite developed yet. So you'd have all these electronic drums all over things and thin key and, you know, wall basses and all these stuff that now is considered, you know, it didn't stand the test of time so well. But the other crazy thing is, even though their album sales kind of started to go down and plateaued. I mean, they were still gold through all that 80s period, but they had this sort of interesting business philosophy where they never went backwards in terms of a live band, and they kept making the live show. This is where their love of technology paid off for them, because they kept throwing money into the live show and being a high-tech live show and doing a lot of video stuff and a lot of props and a lot of cool stuff. So they were always playing the same huge venues as all those other big metal bands were playing all through the 80s, even though there was a pronounced difference in how well embraced their albums were.
Right, right on. I wanted to also mention that I recently watched the documentary, That Little Band from Texas, about ZZ Top, and saw your name on that one too. Man, what a great story that tells. So much good stuff on such a great band, a band that I know you really, really love.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that was so fun working on that. I'm in there as a story consultant, and then I'm in the credits also as a transcriber. So again, it's a situation where I've actually, you know, in my own home office that I'm sitting in now, I would get sent, you know, interviews to transcribe and thinking, oh, this great stuff. So I don't know, maybe I'll check with those guys again at some point and say, let me do a ZZ Top book or something. Right. But no, that was really cool coming up with that. Working early on kind of the story end of it, you know, Ralph Chapman's great writer. He's the chief writer on the thing. And Sam Dunn, of course, was super involved. But yeah, the funny thing was, I recall fond memories of trying to figure out what the story should be, where we should take it to. Ralph had this idea that he wanted to sort of end it around the Viva Las Vegas period and tie it back to Dusty and his love of singing and love of Elvis and stuff. And then I had one thing where I thought, why don't we make this about how this is the quintessential American band? They're like more American than Aerosmith even. They're not as, you know, metaphorically American as Lynyrd Skynyrd, but the thing is, they're not polarizing like Lynyrd Skynyrd either.
Right, right.
Like, everybody loves them. It's not an argument between the left and right with ZZ Top. They're just the most American band ever. So I thought that would be something to push as a storyline. And then I also, my pet storyline more than anything would have been, you know, but of course we couldn't do this. It's not really practical. But I personally am one of the few people that thinks this band's, some of their greatest albums are the ones they made recently. Like, I think Rhythmine is so heavy, and I have this argument with people all the time. It's just this lost, massive gem. It's practically my favorite ZZ Top album. I loved Mescalero.
From like 96 or
97, yeah.
97, yeah.
97. And it might be 96, but Antenna I loved as well. So I loved all those records, XXX not so much, and the last one not so much. But I loved everything else they did from Antenna on. So that was a storyline where I thought, this is one of the key bands that's making some of their best music now, even though nobody cares, because it's just a heritage act and they're just love for the old hits.
Right.
But obviously, as you've seen from the movie, we had to sort of come up with this thing where, okay, you can only say so much, you know, and there's been some complaints about it, right? That ending it essentially with Eliminator, the story of how Eliminator was, but you know, you only have so much time. And we learned that in the Rush movie. It was just really
90 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. We're watching the Rush movie and I remember that thing living as a 4-hour movie for months and months. Then it was a 3-hour movie for months and months. And then like right at the end, boom, down to 88 minutes. Right. Yeah. So, you know, Banger is so high quality in what they do. And they're just agonizing over every second of what can we put in here. And we'd sit in meetings and we'd make notes and we'd say, I guess you could chop that a little bit there maybe or whatever. And then, you know, we'd have to move, the editors would have to move things around, which is just a wild process. But yeah, I mean, they would just polish these things like a diamond to get it to be the perfect story, right? And every fan, everybody at Banger is huge music fans. We would all love every movie to be 4.5 hours long, but you just can't do it.
Right on. But you mentioned Rhythm Mina. I love that song, My Mind Is Gone. Such a one of my favorite ZZ Top songs.
Absolutely. So great heavy. Stuff.
Yeah. AC/DC, I had the honor of being included in a book that you put together a number of years ago, AC/DC album by album. Absolutely. And that was so much fun doing that book with you, talking to you about one of my favorite bands. What do you think the future for AC/DC is? We're hearing maybe there's going to be this album that has leftover stuff that will include stuff, you know, Malcolm had been working on before he passed away. Do you think we're going to get another album by AC/DC, another tour?
Man, I don't know. If it was up to me, if I was their manager or whatever, I would say, you know, for the sake of humankind, prop Brian up in a chair and get him to sing another album. Forget about touring. Who cares? It would just be great to have one more great AC/DC album. None of this Tom Brady going to the Buccaneers stuff. We don't need right. one last AC/DC album with Axel singing or something, right? It's ridiculous, right? I mean, it has to be Brian or no one. Don't even do it, right? So I would just love to see one more album with Brian. I mean, if there was something with leftovers in that, I would hate them to even like make it like an album, like try to call it a last album. I just don't want a mess, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm so bummed out because AC/DC and ZZ Top are probably my two favorite bands ever. You know, I've got a few others that I bring up obviously from time to time, but really when push comes to shove and I think of who has a ton of albums that I love, AC/DC is one of the top two. And it just pains me so much that I hate Rock and Bust.
Right.
Rock or Bust, right? And I love Black Ice, you know? So I wish they would have ended it on Black Ice. But now I wish they would end it on a good album, because I just something about almost every single song or Rock or Bust I don't like. And almost every song on Black Ice I love. I thought that was a masterpiece. And I thought Rock or Bust was a disaster. And I hate that, right? I don't want to see them end on a bad album. So I don't know, man. I don't see why you can't get Brian to dust off those pipes, and all you gotta do is put together 45 minutes. Well, I don't know. That's too short these days, but
right.
So 52 minutes of music. For the sake of the happiness of millions and millions of people, like give us one more good album.
Right on, right on. And Deep Purple, I didn't think we were going to get another album from them, but we apparently are. Whoosh is coming out, and there was a single released. Just wondering if you heard the new Deep Purple track, Throw My Bones.
Hey, man, I'm way beyond you on that one. I've heard the whole thing for weeks. I've interviewed Ian Pace about it. I've interviewed Ian Gillan about it. So I know everything there is to know about that album. I love it. I think it's great. It's a really cool record. I had a great interview with Ian Gillan. Ian Pace is great too. I talked to him about the last album. I mean, I just love that the drummer of the band is such an engaging, charming interview, right? But then I got one with Ian Gillan because the plan is we're going to do a cover story for Goldmine, and you got to, you know, it's got to be a good long article. So I needed kind of both of them. So I held out for Ian, and I'm so glad I did, because he's so good with the lyric stories and stuff like that. Right. You don't want to get him talking about Bob Ezrin, because he kind of gives you the same story that Ian Pace gives you. And it's kind of general stuff, but he will gladly talk about the motivation behind the lyrics and stuff, which is so cool when he does that. But it's another one of these super creative albums with a lot of daring music on it. You know, a few songs that are kind of normal. One thing I don't like is it's kind of got a similar arrangement throughout. It just feels like it's all kind of one tone. Like they've turned into this band where it's hard to explain. Like, nothing sounds super heavy out of them anymore, and nothing sounds super light out of them anymore. Like, like, it's just this arrangement where there's this massive rhythm section. The guitars are kind of like, it's really lush and well recorded, but it doesn't, it just doesn't sound at all raw or heavy. You know what I mean? Right. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's really creative. And like Ian said, you know, and he was so right about this. He goes, I'm astonished that this late in our career, guys our age, we could be so creative and so into it.
It's awesome.
And, you know, this is like six records, I think, with Steve Morse from this era. And I love this era. I think Abandon's amazing. That's one that they don't think is amazing. It's almost my favorite one. Perpendicular. Everybody loves Perpendicular. So I just think, you know, out of all the bands that made their best music late in their career, it's Deep Purple number one. And I thought, like I was saying, ZZ Top, I think Cheap Trick, Motorhead are a couple that I thought.
Yeah, sure.
Bunch of their great albums late. Your Eye Heap, great, great albums late in their career now, right? So, yeah. So, yeah, sorry. I could talk you talk your ear off about Deep Purple.
Right on. Well, Martin, it's always great talking with you and hearing your opinions on things and reading your books like Anthem, Rush in the 70s. Highly recommended. Great time to read a book, guys. We're going to be probably under quarantine here for, oh, God, who knows how much longer. What do you think, Martin? Is the 2020 concerts season over, or will we get some in the late summer, you think?
It's pretty wild. I mean, I think you're getting a little bit of this. Everybody's talking about the plateauing, especially in Europe and a little bit in the States. But I think there's also people are getting real cabin fever. And I think you're going to see people really trying to figure out ways to go back to work. Today, the stock market went up 1,200 points. So I don't know. It's funny. I mean, to think, I think everybody's thinking, I can't do exactly this for even to the end of April, let alone to the end of May. Like, people, all sorts of, you know, sensible people are saying at least till the end of May. And then a lot of other people like are, you know, ringing the doom bell that you can't put the economy into this much of an induced coma even another 3 weeks, let alone 6 weeks, right? And then people are saying into the summer, and then Dr. Fauci's saying this is the new standard, and then everybody's saying it'll come back in a second wave. You know, we're going to get the warm weather, right? And that's supposed to get rid of it, but then the weather gets cold again, and what happens? Oh, man, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, the thing we've learned through the years is that the pundits and all these people on TV generally can't predict the future because it's just they so much of it ends up being wrong. And having said that, I'm trying to stay optimistic. I don't expect to be at any shows in May or maybe even June, but I'm still got my fingers crossed for July.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the last of our concerns. Like, the big gathering of crowds is the last of our concerns. I think having all the factories running again is a heck of a lot more important.
Good point.
Like just stores open and stuff, right? Like most of the stores and most of the factories, you know. But to think about, you know, I think cramming a bunch of people into a club to watch a show is probably the last thing that's going to be allowed. Right. And it just seems like antithetical to the social distancing the most. I think you really want to see, okay, can we figure out how to run the damn factory? I think that's the most important thing.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. All right, Martin. Well, thank you so much. Please stay safe up there. You're in Toronto, right?
Yep. 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 Yeah, it's about the same level as, you know, everything locked down, pretty severe as pretty much anywhere else in the world, except, you know, you keep hearing about various places in the States that haven't had it so bad yet. But no, it's quite a lockdown city, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, stay safe. And again, your book, Anthem, Rush in the 70s, and that'll be followed by Limelight.
Yep.
In what, Russian September, 80. I think September 2020, they're October-ish, saying for that, October-ish, and then Driven, it will be Driven, the third book.
Cool. Yep.
Well, I'm really enjoying Anthem and look forward to reading Limelight and Driven. All on Rush by Martin Popoff. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, man. Thank you. And congrats on what you've done here. I mean, this is a heck of an established podcast universe you've created. It's pretty amazing, you guys.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, we were one of the first, and yeah. 15 years later, still doing our thing. Sometimes I scratch my head as to why, but you know, I love doing it. There you cool. go.
All right, man. We'll talk to you later.
All right, man. Take care.
Okay, see ya.
YYZ here on Talking Metal. Big thanks to Martin for joining us. Guys, stay safe. Continue to wash your hands. Hopefully we're over the hump now. I don't know what's going on. I want things to go back to normal. Rest in peace, Neil Peart.